is dark matter signals at colliders. And this is, as with most of what I've spoken about so far, somewhat biased towards WIMP dark matter. It doesn't have to be necessarily a weakly interacting particle, but some fairly massive particle that has some non-negligible interaction with the standard model. Because obviously, if you don't interact with the standard model, you're not going to be able to make it at a collider. And tomorrow, and possibly a little bit at the end of today, I'm going to talk about axions, which are a very different way to get dark matter. And it's an interesting theory. The experimental signatures are maybe a bit less interesting. It's a bit harder to look for because these turn out to be very light particles that couple very weakly. But I think it's also important that you see what axions are all about. So let me get to dark matter colliders. But before I do, any questions? Okay, so at least in the case of WIMP dark matter and WIMP-like dark matter, we might be able to make it at colliders. And we might be able to study the dark matter particles directly. So the two tools we have, the two most useful tools for relatively heavy stuff are the Tevatron. So the Tevatron, unfortunately, just shut down, but they still have a fair bit of data they're sitting on. And this was a proton, antiproton collider. It collided beams at about 2 TeV center of mass energy. And they have roughly 10 inverse femtobarns of data. So this characterization of amounts of data in terms of so-called inverse femtobarns, sometimes this is called the integrated luminosity. And the point is that if I have a if I have a cross section, let's say, of 10 femtobarns, then with 10 inverse femtobarns of data, I'm going to get 10 times 10 equals 100 events. So it's a way in some sense you're dividing the number of events by the cross section, and that gives you the so-called integrated luminosity. So in general, your number of events is integrated luminosity times cross section. Okay, so the Tevatron is that. The LHC, at least up until recently, they're running at a 7 TeV center of mass energy. This is a proton-proton collider, not proton-antiproton. And they have, at the moment, about 5 inverse femtobarns of data. But at the moment, they're actually running at 8 TeV, which actually does make a difference in terms of cross sections. And we expect, well, if everything goes well, they should be up to about 20 inverse femtobarns of data by the end of the year. So these are the two big games in town at the moment. And a typical dark matter particle, we know it has to be stable, electrically neutral. So neutral under electromagnetism and strong. They can still have weak interactions. But the upshot of this is that these properties imply that the dark matter particle is invisible in a typical high energy particle collider detector. So, for example, one process you can imagine having at the LHC is I've got a proton coming in here, a proton coming in here, and from this proton I get a quark, this proton I get an anti-quark, and for example, you can imagine making a Z, and then producing a pair of dark matter particles. So in this way, I could produce dark matter at the LHC, for example. The only problem is that this stuff on its own is completely invisible. So even though you make these particles, you don't actually see these events because the dark matter particles just fly out of your detector and give you nothing. Okay, so this alone, so producing dark matter alone, it's no good. But in many cases, you don't produce dark matter alone. In many cases, you don't produce dark matter alone. And if you produce dark matter in conjunction with other stuff, then the fact that the dark matter particles are invisible actually leads to a very distinctive signal, which is called missing energy for not too surprising reasons. So suppose I have a collision of, for example, two protons, and I've got my collision, and out of this collision, I've got various particles. But suppose a couple of these particles are dark matter, and everything else is visible. So if I look at the net, if I apply momentum conservation to this, things might end up looking funny, because some of the momentum is going to be carried off by these dark matter particles, but you don't actually pick up those dark matter particles in the detector. So the trick to seeing dark matter is that you look for imbalances in the total momentum. Now, it turns out that for these hadron colliders, these PP or PP bar colliders, because the things you're colliding are not elementary particles, even though you're in the center of mass frame of the protons, because the things that are actually colliding are things like quarks or antiquarks or gluons that are part of the proton, they don't carry the whole proton's energy, you don't actually know what the longitudinal center of mass frame is. So in other words, even though you're in the proton center of mass frame, or proton-antiproton center of mass frame, you're not in the quark-quark or quark-antiquark or glue-glue center of mass frame. So that means that in general, for a given event, you don't know what the net boost is along the beam axis. But you do know that you're going to conserve momentum in the transverse plane. So the coordinates people usually use are z along the beam axis. And then the transverse plane is so-called xy plane. So this is the beam direction. And for example, in a given event, if I project everything onto the transverse plane, you can imagine having, for example, a pair of visible particles and a pair of dark matter particles. And if I look at the sum of the momenta, so if I sum up these momenta, the total momentum in this plane has to cancel, but I'm going to get some net visible momentum, and this is going to be equal and opposite to the net momentum of the chi's. And the point is that the only momentum fraction that I see is the green bit, the visible momentum, and I have and it looks like I'm violating momentum conservation. So because we have a lot of confidence in momentum conservation, we identify momentum imbalances typically with invisible particles. So what we usually define is so-called missing transverse energy, and that is you take up the sum, you take the sum over all let me first define the missing transverse momentum, and that is a vector quantity that's the sum over all visible particles of the PTs. So all the transverse momenta, so all the momenta projected on the transverse plane of all visible particles. And because the missing momentum is going to be the opposite of that, so that everything cancels out, this is what I call the missing momentum. And people will also often talk about missing energy. And this is typically taken to be just the modulus of the missing energy vector, missing momentum vector.
I'm not exactly sure, but when people talk about signatures of extra dimensions, they also talk about missing energy. And so, what tests? How could we distinguish, say, between the two signatures?
It also depends very much on what extra-dimensional model you have. So for example, in UED models, which are extra-dimensional models, you're going to get a signal that's very similar to supersymmetry. So I'll talk about supersymmetry in a second. But there are also other extra-dimensional models, particularly large extra dimensions, where you can also lose energy to gravitons or to kk gravitons or some combination of them. And there you get missing energy. You get missing energy in that case, and that signal actually ends up also looking like a dark matter signal. So it's not, so from the start, it's not necessarily obvious how to distinguish them. If you start to apply various kinematic cuts, the shapes of the distributions they produce can be a little bit different. But in general, missing energy is a difficult game. And, well, I guess the first thing is we'd like to have a missing energy signal for one reason or another. And then it's sort of a second order step, actually figuring out where it comes from. So but that is a good point. Just because we see missing energy at a collider doesn't necessarily mean we found dark matter. So for example, I could produce particles that aren't the dark matter. I could produce, so suppose these chi's aren't the dark matter, but suppose these chi's are neutral under the strong and electromagnetic forces, but suppose these chi's decay after 1 second. Now, these particles coming out typically are pretty close to the speed of light, and the distance you travel at the speed of light is, in 1 second, is much, much farther than the size of the detector, which is maybe 10 meters across or so. So just because you see missing energy at a collider doesn't mean you found dark matter, but it is a specific signature that dark matter will produce. So you can't conclude from a missing energy signal that you have dark matter. On the other hand, what you'd like to do is find evidence for dark matter from a combination of colliders, direct detection, and indirect detection, and try to find a consistent picture of the particle properties that match everything. But that is a good point. Just because you find missing energy doesn't mean that it's dark matter.
So the missing energy for neutrinos, they're
what? Oh, I'll get to that in a second, too. Yeah. I think that was about to be my next point. That's actually the next thing I was going to say. So dark matter is one way to get missing energy, but the standard model also produces missing energy. And two of the sources are, of course, neutrino. So neutrinos I can also produce in various standard model processes, and I don't see them in the detector. They don't interact enough, they just fly out of the detector. But the other thing, another way you can get missing energy is you can mismeasure QCD jets or other objects in the detector. So another way to find an apparent momentum imbalance is to just not measure the momentum right, which happens some fraction of the time. Typically, though, the momentum imbalances you get there, because we have pretty good control over measuring the momentum of objects, the missing energy you'll get from mismeasuring stuff tends to be pretty small. With neutrinos, because they're very light, you also tend to get not very large amounts of missing energy. Whereas for a heavy dark matter particle, you tend to get a lot more. So I'll give an example of that in a second. Okay. In the case of dark matter, though, there are two interesting ways to get nice missing energy signals. And the first is in cascade decays. So I'll explain what this is in a second. And the second is in ISR. So ISR stands for initial state. Radiation. Okay, so let me start with cascades. Just so I don't block this, I'll move it up a bit. Oh, actually, is it too high? So with cascades, the idea is that the dark matter particle has other friends. And what I mean by friends are particles that share something in common with the dark matter, but not necessarily the standard model. So the canonical example of this So the canonical example of this is supersymmetry. And in supersymmetry, you have lots of superpartners. And the dark matter particle happens to just be the lightest one. So in supersymmetry, with your dark matter being the lightest supersymmetric particle, you have superpartners. And the lightest superpartner happens to be the dark matter. But at a hadron collider, because your initial states are hadronic, because your initial states involve quarks and gluons, the particles you're most likely to produce, in most cases, are particles that are also charged under the strong force. So the idea here, for example, is I've got my protons colliding. So proton, and then I have some collision process that I'm not going to say what exactly it is, but some collision process. And for example, in supersymmetry, I could produce a squark anti-squark pair. And given a squark, assuming the squark isn't the lightest superpartner, and we don't want it to be because otherwise it would be a charged stable particle, this squark is going to decay down to the LSP. So I'll assume it's the lightest neutralino by spitting out a quark. So this is an example of a cascade decay in that I produce one thing, and then it decays down to the LSP by spitting off a standard model particle. And in principle, I can have more complicated cascades where I start emitting multiple quarks, or this might not be the lightest superpartner. This might be, let's say, a heavier neutralino, and then I have another decay chain step, and so on. But the upshot of all of these processes is that I'm going to get some set of standard model stuff plus two neutralino LSPs from every event. So the thing I look for are things like, so a typical signal will involve some set of QCD jets, so n QCD jets, plus some other set of standard model leptons, plus missing energy. So this combination gives me some set of different channels to look for supersymmetry in, and in particular, dark matter. And if you go and look at the LHC or CMS collaboration searches for supersymmetry, ATLAS and CMS are the two big detectors at the LHC. You'll find that their searches are typically organized in this way, in terms of number of jets and number of leptons, with some requirement of missing energy. So what you expect, if there's a signal, is that what you do is you look at your number of events as a function of energy. So I've got some distribution of, if I look at all my events and I make a histogram of those events according to the total amount of missing energy, in that in those events, what I expect, let me try to get some colorful chalk here. What I expect is that for the standard model, my usual standard model expectation is some distribution that falls off very quickly. So this is my standard model expectation, and if I have a supersymmetric spectrum, the specific spectrum will depend on the mass of the superpartners. But more typically, I get some distribution that gives me much more missing energy out to larger values of missing energy. So I get many more events with large missing energy than I would just in the standard model. So even though I do expect missing energy from the standard model, by looking at this kinematic distribution, I can get information I can figure out that there's something not just standard model in the data. And in principle, I can also look at the shape of this distribution very carefully. And I can also look at the relative event rates in these different channels. And that starts to tell me about what the spectrum of superpartners is. And in particular, if you start doing really well, you can start to extract the couplings and the mass of the latest superpartner. And you try to correlate those properties with other tests for dark matter. So this is the first way to look for dark matter at colliders. The second way is the so-called ISR technique. Up a little. The second way to go is ISR, and that's initial state radiation. And the idea of the idea of ISR is that let me just go back up to the diagram I drew here. The idea of ISR is, for example, I could have a production of dark matter through this kind of channel. And some fraction of the time, most of the time, I'm going to produce my dark matter just alone. But some fraction of the time, from these quarks, I can also radiate off a gluon. And this gluon, some smaller fraction of the time, is going to have a high transverse momentum. So the signal in the ISR case is roughly one jet, or possibly even one photon. I could also radiate off a photon. So the ISR signal is one jet or photon, and basically nothing else. So based on the kinematics in the transverse plane, I know that if I just see one jet, I obviously have missing energy, because all the momentum is going in that one direction. And the idea is that in this case, we expect that the invisible particles are carrying an equal and opposite amount. So this is the ISR story. The other thing is that this story is, the kind of neat thing here is this story is very closely related to direct detection. And that is that if I look at the kind of process that involves direct detection. Again, I'm not specifying what goes on in the middle, but in direct detection, I have dark matter in, dark matter out, and I have quark or possibly gluon in, quark or possibly gluon out. And if I just take this Feynman diagram, right, I'm not specifying what's going on in the middle, and I rotate it, what I get is quark, anti-quark, and dark matter, dark matter. So as I mentioned previously, if this is all I have, this kind of event is invisible. But I can also radiate off a QCD jet, or possibly photon. And in that case, I get a monojet signal. And very roughly, if I look at the cross-section for this process, the cross-section for this process goes like roughly alpha s times the cross-section for the zero jet, where alpha s is the strong coupling squared over 4 pi evaluated at the relevant energy scale to the process. Okay, so the point is that the zero jet cross section is very closely related to the direct detection cross section, and to get an extra jet, the extra jet cross section is also related to the zero jet cross section, which is related to direct detection, but with the alpha s factor. Now, for this process, it's actually very instructive to look at how these cross sections scale with energy. Okay, so I'm going to assume that this jet has a missing has a transverse momentum equal to pt. So if we look at the rough dependence of the cross sections, well, the cross section for direct detection is going to have the parametric dependence of so I'll explain what this stuff is in a second. So the parametric dependence of the direct detection cross section, oops, maybe I wrote this wrong, it should be a G, is going to be something that goes like the mass of the mediator. So for example, if I have some particle of mass M connecting here to here, and this mass is at least reasonably large, then the cross section is going to scale like 1 over its mass to the fourth. And this vertex, the strength of this vertex, I'm calling GQ. And the strength of this vertex, I'm calling G chi. So the stuff that goes into this cross section, where here I've used the kinematics, this is the sort of the energy scale of the process, and this is the thing that you get from the propagator. The stuff that goes into here is based on this very simplified picture. So I can compare that to the cross section for one jet. And the cross section for one jet really depends on whether the PT of the jet is lighter or heavier than this mediator particle. So I'll do two cases. So when the energy scale is much, much larger, then this mass scale, the cross section just goes like 1 over pt squared. But if your pt is less than the mediator mass, the cross section goes like pt squared over m to the fourth. So we'll be mostly interested in this case, but we may also look at this case. But if you look at this case, and I compare this cross section to this cross section, I have the same 1 over m to the fourth. I have the same couplings here that appear here. But now I have an extra alpha s. So alpha s, it turns out numerically, is about 0.1. So I get a little bit of suppression from alpha s. But on the other hand, if I look at the kinematic dependence, and I assume my dark matter is, let's say, like order 50 to 100 GeV or heavier, this mu is roughly the proton mass. So this quantity goes like proton mass squared over m to the fourth, whereas here, this process goes like pt squared over m to the fourth, and a typical pt I'm going to have is on the order of 100 GeV for a Tevatron or LHC experiment. So that means that if I focus on a case where m is roughly larger than the pt, and I compare and I take a ratio of the cross-sections, I look at the one jet relative to the direct detection cross-section, this is going to scale roughly like alpha s pt squared over mu p squared. And if I put in numbers, this is roughly 10 to the 3 pt over mu over 100 GeV squared. So the point is that the relative cross sections that I probe with this one jet versus direct detection, I get a big enhancement. So of course, we also have to compare sensitivities to these two types of detection methods. And in terms of sensitivities at the experiments, in terms of sensitivities for spin independent, I have limits on the order of 10 to the 44 centimeter squared, which I can convert this into femtobarons. So remember that ten to the minus 39 centimeters squared is one inverse femtobaron. One baron, if you recall, is 10 to the minus 24 centimeters squared. And the typical limit from spin dependent is more like 10 to the minus 38 centimeters squared. And this is about 10 femtobarons. On the other hand, the sensitivity at colliders to one jet cross-section with a PT of about 100 GeV is, it turns out to be on the order of about 500 femtobarons.
Cross-sections for the drag detection we get from the other experiment that we do,
right? So the point is my direct searches based on direct detection experiments give me limits of about this size on dark matter masses. Whereas the collider experiments give me a limit on one jet cross-sections with a PT of about 100 GeV of about 500 femtobarons. So now if I compare the 500 femtobarons to these cross-sections and I take into account this scaling, that means that, at least naively, it looks like the collider search will be better than spin dependent, but maybe a bit worse than spin independent. So far, I've just given you a rough scaling argument, but there have been some papers in the past few years that have made this rough scaling more precise. So there have been some studies recently that have made the scaling argument more precise. And of course, to make a specific conclusion, you need to specify what operators you're looking at. Let me give you two specific examples. One kind of operator I can look at, corresponding both to colliders and dark matter scattering, I'll call it O1. Is g chi gq over p squared minus m squared chi bar chi q bar q. So a scalar-scalar interaction. And this will produce spin-independent dark matter direct detection scattering. And a second operator you can look at is the axial vector and this mediates spin dependent. And I could have also looked at vector-vector, but I'll just concentrate on these two for now. Okay. So you can
the P, the moment is the moment of the mediator
part. Yeah. Yeah, so it's a momentum. It's effectively the momentum transferred in the reaction. So for colliders, it'll be roughly the center mass energy in the quark frame, and in dark matter direct detection, it'll be the momentum transferred to the nucleus. Okay, so what has been done, as far as the story goes, is that you take these operators, and you look at the limits. On this kind of interaction from collider searches. And specifically, you use collider search data from Atlas or Tevatron, or sorry, LHC or Tevatron searches for monojets. So you look for searches for one hard jet plus missing energy. And this gives you some, this gives you a limit on this combination of parameters. And you can translate that limit on this combination of parameters into a limit on direct detection cross-sections. So let me draw the two results. I should have room here. Just to split this in half. Some colorful chalk. All right. So if I start off with a spin independent case corresponding to O1, I've got my limits on the spin independent cross section as a function of the dark matter mass. And this is 10 to the minus 44, 10 to the minus 40, 10 to the minus 36, and this is the centimeter squared. And for, I guess I'll put in some dark matter masses. This is 100 GeV. So we know that spin-independent direct detection experiments give you a limit that looks something like that. So the exclusion region from direct detection spin-independent searches rules out the region in here. So the allowed region is everything below it. On the other hand, if you look at the limit on this kind of operator from collider searches, from the LHC and so on, what you get are limits that look something like this. So the collider limits rule out stuff above this line. So for heavier dark matter, heavier than a few GeV, the direct detection spin independent limits are still the best ones. But at the low mass region, you actually get better limits from colliders, and under the assumption that this is the operator you have. So this is a bit of an advancement, but typically we consider slightly heavier dark matter masses, so this is moderately interesting. If your dark matter scatters spin dependently, this is the case based on our scaling argument that we expect to have a big improvement. So spin dependent O2. And what you get here, we'll do a similar result. And that's, here's my 1, 10, 100 GeV. And I'll focus on the spin-dependent cross-section in the proton case. And let me label the axes, 10 to the minus 40. OK, so I'm using a different scale here, just to warn you. The current spin-dependent direct detection bounds looks something like this. Whereas my collider bounds look something like this. So in this direct detection case, in the spin-dependent case, my colliders are actually ruling out a lot of the region these spin-dependent experiments are looking for. Now, having said that, in this larger mass region, remember yesterday we spoke about solar capture of dark matter, and in the case of solar capture of dark matter, you also get limits from from not seeing this neutrino flux from the sun. And this is also a little bit more model dependent, but depending on how your dark matter annihilates, your limits from neutrino experiments lie somewhere somewhere between here and here. And that depending on how the dark matter annihilates, you have to be either be above this line or somewhere in between. And the specific limit depends on where you on how you annihilate. But on the other hand, these limits only go down to finite energies, because these this neutrino signal is only visible for high energy neutrinos. So this story is actually pretty nice, because you're seeing that we have lots of different ways to look for dark matter. Unfortunately, we haven't seen a clear signal yet. But one kind of fun thing about the whole dark matter story is that you have all these different methods and techniques to look for dark matter. And you have an interesting interplay between these very, very different experiments, from these very high precision direct detection searches to neutrino telescopes, all the way down to all the way up to particle colliders. Okay, so this is basically everything I wanted to say about dark matter colliders. This is basically the story. I mean, there are lots of specific details that can be looked into, but they tend to be fairly numerical, and it's not really minimal to talking about on the blackboard. But I want to move on to axions now. But first of all, are there any questions?
So I have a general comment. Like, I mean, suppose that we start seeing missing mass, missing energy, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Experimentally, we would be entering in a very strange phase, because presumably the detectors that we can make can only interact with standard model kind of particles. So whereas, you know, a lot of the new physics which is coming in, which of course one of them is dark matter, always involves, a lot of times involves like missing energy, and I guess kind of, you know, so what I'm trying to kind of see is that, you know, I mean, this is like a general thing that I'm just thinking about, that we are probably, you know, the experimental challenges are going to be quite, I don't know how they're going to be met, or, you know, so.
Yeah. But I mean, it really comes down to, to really trust a measurement of dark matter, you want to see it in a lot of different ways.
Right.
And that's where having these multiple different search methods that have relatively similar sensitivities at the moment are really interesting. So in all these fronts, the collider front's getting better, the direct detection search is getting better, the solar neutrino search is getting better, the indirect detection searches are getting better. In all these senses, there's a lot of progress, and the progress is somewhat correlated. But are you worried about the fact that with missing energy, you're not actually detecting the particle itself?
Right.
It's just, yeah. I mean, in some sense, I mean, I think a kind of a analogous objection was made to the atomic model, let's say, like hundreds of years ago. Okay, it's we can't see atoms. What are they useful? Are they just mathematical constructs?
Right.
But at the same time, for direct detection, you really are seeing the dark matter hit something.
Right.
And in the collider case, even though you're not seeing the dark matter as the final state, it is influencing the energy momentum of the visible stuff around it.
Right.
So even though you're not detecting that particle itself, you're seeing its effect on other stuff. And I mean, you can argue that what we do with atoms is analogous. But you probe at, like, you don't look at atoms under a microscope, but you do. Well, I guess, I mean, you almost kind of are now with nano stuff. But for the most part, you look at the effects of atoms on like the pressure or like absorption lines or so on. Yeah, but I mean, I mean, I, I would be happy to have this problem, in the sense that I'd be happy to have lots of missing energy signals and have to worry about what they are. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to switch gears for a little bit, for the rest of a little bit of today and for tomorrow, and talk about axions. So for this, I'm going to do a little bit of warm-up, and I think and Tipper will do a little bit of warm-up in the tutorial today. It's related to this. Actually, I think one blackboard should be enough, so I'll just start here. Okay, so the last topic I wanted to cover, of course, are axions. So axions are really, really light particles. They can still be cold, dark matter. And before I tell you what axions are to start with, let me start off by just talking about so-called pure QCD. And pure QCD means just an SUN gauge theory, so just a non-abelian gauge theory with no matter, so no quarks. So in this case, my Lagrangian, or at least I can describe my theory with a Lagrangian. And this Lagrangian, the main part of it, is the so-called gauge kinetic term. And this gauge kinetic term has a sum over adjoint stuff, and this has the form. D mu a nu minus d nu a nu plus interactions. So have you guys done non-abelian gauge theories at all? Okay. So it says so you've seen this more complicated field strength, and you can think of this in a sense as covariant derivatives. Where this is the covariant derivative of acting on the vector. Now it turns out that in gauge theories, in non-abelian ones, there's actually a second non-trivial term I can write down. And I'm going to write it this way. So by g tilde, I mean epsilon mu nu rho sigma GA rho sigma. So I just contract this this tensor with the anti-symmetric symbol. And then I use that to contract with that instead of contracting just directly. Okay, so the second piece, and then on top of that, in principle, I have gauge fixing stuff like ghosts or so on. But we're not going to worry too much about the gauge fixing stuff. Just assume we've done it. Okay, so this piece is the piece we all know and love. This piece might not be entirely familiar to you. But this piece, first of all, if I start to look at it, for a lot of what you do in QCD, you can ignore it. And the reason you can ignore it in a lot of cases, is that if I look at this so-called GG tilde term, where I'm suppressing all the indices, this piece can actually be written as a total divergence. So it turns out that there exists some four-vector K mu such that this GG tilde is equal to the divergence of it. And that means that when I take this effective Lagrangian and I put it into an action, where I integrate over all space-time, this piece reduces to a boundary term. So in other words, a term at space-time infinity. So normally, normally this kind of thing we could just drop and say that all my fields go to zero infinity. Now, I'm going to have to wave my hands here because I don't have time to go through the whole story. But it turns out that non-abelian gauge theories, so any non-abelian gauge theory, it turns out, has a non-trivial vacuum structure. And because of the non-trivial vacuum structure, it turns out that you're not allowed to ignore these boundary terms. You actually have to keep them around because they can lead to physical effects in some cases. So the upshot is that I'm not allowed to get rid of this. But one nice thing is that at least because this thing is a total divergence, we can reduce it to a boundary term. And even though we can't get rid of the boundary term, at least if we look at local effects, and by local effects, this corresponds roughly to perturbation theory, this term doesn't contribute. So we can't get rid of it. So we can't completely ignore it. But in the case of doing perturbation theory, which only depends on local effects, we can't ignore it. So we can't completely ignore this boundary term, this GD tilde, but we can ignore it as far as perturbation theory goes. So for the most part, if we're computing perturbative scattering in QCD, this thing doesn't play a role. But it can be important if we look at so-called non-perturbative effects, so perturbative effects that aren't picked up by the usual perturbative expansion. And in particular, if I look at QCD at low energies, non-perturbative effects become really, really important because my theory becomes strongly coupled. So the first point is that because of the funny vacuum structure of non-abelian gauge theories, QCD in principle has this additional term in its effective Lagrangian, the so-called theta term, corresponding to a GD tilde interaction. Let me also say that the value of theta, the different values of theta, in a sense, correspond to different non-trivial vacuum configurations. They're physically equivalent, but they're also distinct. And one more thing, it turns out that theta lives in the range 0 to 2 pi. Because it turns out that this boundary term typically reduces to an integer times 8 pi over alpha s. And when I integrate it over all space, I just get this thing just turns into a phase. Okay, so that's the first thing I wanted to say. The next thing I want to do is take my pure QCD and add in matter. So I'm just going to do a very simplified QCD. I'm going to add a fermion. And in this case, my effective Lagrangian, again, is just the usual QCD part. So I'll write this first piece as g mu nu squared. I'll write the second piece as alpha s over 8 pi theta g tilde. And I'm going to add in a fermion that's, let's say, a fundamental under the non-abelian gauge group. So this is just some covariant derivative for the fermion. And I'm also going to write a mass term. And the mass term generically has the form, has this form. And this kinetic term for the fermion, if you recall, I can also split it into left, and right. Where, if you recall, my psi, I can write it as psi left, 0 plus 0, psi right. OK, so normally this piece we just write as m times psi bar psi. But I'm going to assume that this mass term is not quite real. So in other words, I'm going to assume the mass term how will I write it? I'll write it e to the I gamma. So First of all, by writing the mass term in this way, it's easy to check that this is explicitly real in the sense that this piece is a Hermitian conjugate of that. So that's why instead of just writing psi by psi, if I'd only written psi bar psi with a complex mass, it wouldn't have been real, and you need everything in your action to be real. Okay, so what we can do to make the mass term real is redefine our fields. So we can redefine our field variables, and to do that, I'm going to write new fields in terms of the old fields, and I can do this separately for the left and right-handed fields. So these are my original fields, and then I'm defining some new field variables, psi prime and left prime and psi right prime, with slightly different phases. And now if I plug this in here, well, this term is going to keep the same form in that the phases just cancel out. So I get psi bar psi, psi bar psi, psi bar psi. And if I look at the mass term, my mass term becomes, I'll write it as m e to the I gamma. This piece is going to give me a minus gamma L. This will give me a plus gamma L. And the second piece is just the Hermitian conjugate of the first. OK, so if I choose my gamma left and gamma right, such that gamma left minus gamma right is equal to gamma, then I get effectively a real mass term. In my Lagrangian, and things are looking good. So at this point, it looks like this phase in the mass term is completely unphysical, in that I can just get rid of it by redefining my field variables and be done with it. Now it turns out that that's not quite true. And I think I just have enough time for the punchline of that before finishing up. It turns out that that's not quite true. I assume you folks did quantum field theory in terms of path integrals?
Yeah.
Good, okay. And there is an additional effect of this transformation. And that additional effect of the transformation is that if I look at the path integral measure, so in my path integral, I integrate over all fields, over all field configurations. And this path integral measure has integrals over left and right-handed components. And it turns out that when I change my field variables, I get a non-trivial Jacobian. So this Jacobian is a very subtle point about quantum field theory that took people a long time to sort out. It's actually very, very closely related to so-called anomalies. But the point is that when I do this change of variables, I also pick up a Jacobian factor. And it turns out that this Jacobian factor can be written as an exponential. And this exponential takes a form that should be somewhat familiar, gamma L minus gamma R G tilde. So the upshot of this is that when I make this change of variables, I have to pay one price. And the price that I pay is that in making the mass term real, I end up shifting theta. So the upshot of this is that the net effect of making the mass term real is theta goes to theta bar equal to theta plus gamma L minus gamma R. And remember, this is equal to gamma, the phase I had in the fermion mass matrix. OK, so it turns out that this theta term has a physical consequence in QCD. And that physical consequence, before I talk about the physical consequence, let me say that this generalizes, if I have multiple fermions, to theta transforms to theta bar is equal to theta plus the argument of the determinant of the quark mass matrix. So if I had multiple fermions and I had a mass matrix, instead of just getting this phase, I would have gotten the argument as the determinant of it. In this case, my mass matrix is just 1 by 1. So the determinant is just m e to the I gamma. When I take its argument, I get gamma, so everything matches up. Okay, so the physical consequence in the puzzle is that it turns out that this theta generates a permanent dipole moment for the neutron. Oh, I'll just be a second. And this permanent dipole moment for the neutron is roughly 10 to the minus 15 times theta bar. But we know that in practice, its magnitude has to be less than about 10 to the minus 26 or so. So the puzzle is that this effective theta bar in QCD has to be less than 10 to the minus 11 or so. Whereas its range of parameters it can take is somewhere between 0 and 2 pi. And in QCD, we know that the quark mass matrix gets phases from CKM mixing. And given that, because theta bar lives between 0 and 2 pi, there's just no obvious reason why theta bar should be this small. So this puzzle, why theta bar has to be so small when we don't see any good reason for it, is called the strong CP problem. And axions, it turns out, are particles that fix the strong CP problem. And roughly the punchline is going to be that the axion particle is also going to couple to GG tilde. And instead of having a theta here, we're going to have a dynamical axion field. And that dynamical axion field is going to find a minimum such that the effect of theta bar goes to 0. So okay, I've run over time, so let me finish up there. I guess you have a tutorial this afternoon, and I'll post your last homework soon. And your last homework might be a little bit unconventional, but it should also be not too much work.